Hello and welcome to the Monocle Summer Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Pounds, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, we'll be talking art, lost masterpieces, and how to spot them. Andrew Ellis, director of Art UK, will be here to explain the Art Detective website, an online resource dedicated to unearthing buried treasure.
We'll also be seeing out the summer with Monocle's Athens correspondent, Natalie Savarikas. She's been enjoying the city's open-air film festival.
And we'll be going cross-country with author Karen Flett, whose new book celebrates the classic styling of vintage Airstream trailers, that staple of the US open road.
That is all coming up, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be looking forward to next week's news, and we'll play some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. One last time for the summer, Tom. Give it up.
I know. It has felt at times this past week, here in London at least, that summer was decisively gone. I had to turn on the heating in my house, Rob.
Did you? You had the heating on already?
It was very brisk.
Was it?
Midweek.
Okay.
Not mood-wise. The actual temperature was low. Always a warm...
Everything's well in the Edwards household.
Always a warm hearth. Why am I going there? Let's move on. How's the week been for you, Rob? Treated you well?
It's been fairly
busy.
Seeming
fine fettle.
It's been okay, but it's been fairly busy. I've been trying to take advantage of the sun, race out the office, get into the garden here at Midori House, get a bit of sun on the face in order to get over the thrill and excitement of putting our last newspaper to bed, put the October issue of the magazine to bed, put out some amazing radio stuff as well. It's been a busy week. I think I'm in need of
what do you need? A rub down?
Yes. I think I'm in need of a warm hearth.
Shall we snuggle up to the inviting radio bosom of Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan?
Sadly, I think we don't have a choice.
Henry, oh Henry, blow the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry, blow the way you take this hop.
But how am I doing now?
Everything is all.
Hi, Henry.
Hello. I like that intro. Thanks very much, guys.
Toddling along to the studio this Sunday lunchtime.
Toddling?
Toddling along?
That's more offensive than anything else you said.
Why is toddling along offensive?
Something about that. Toddling.
Toddling along.
I think that's endearing. Yeah. I'm sure the spirit.
Toddling along. You're not in a hurry.
Okay.
You're kind of coming in. It's definitely pleasure for you, not work. I can tell that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not like he said parading in like some weird angular emu or something like that, which would have been offensive.
Yeah.
Is that how you would put it?
That's how I just did put it.
On the 3rd of September, we will witness the first and the only debate between Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, and her rival Martin Schulz. It's going to be broadcast on 4 different stations, 2 public, 2 private. And this is weird. Each station is going to have a representative. Each station is going to submit a journalist. They're going to work in teams of 2. It's going to be an hour and a half long, the broadcast, and the teams of 2 are going to kind of tag in and out halfway through. Isn't that strange?
So that's not a simulcast. It's going to be 4 debates over the 4, 2 public, 2 private broadcasters.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's a simulcast.
All 4 stations are doing it at the same time.
Yeah.
You choose which one you like the most.
Yeah.
That's preposterous.
And each one has its own representative, and they have to work in weird teams.
So in the UK, you've got two choices, haven't you? So you've either got the might of the BBC, or you've got something like, or you've got Monocle 24. They're basically two choices, right?
The only choices.
They're the only two choices. Right?
I can't think of any other broadcasters.
But in Germany, there's not only 4, but there's simulcasting this thing.
Yeah, they all have it's a joint production.
Yeah.
They all want a bit of the pie, and they've put forward their best people. But that means there's actually going to be more interrogators than there are candidates.
How would you win that ratings battle? I'd have definitely a Kardashian fronting the broadcast.
That would be good.
That would be the way to do it. That'd be the only way to show a difference fairness of the other.
Could you do like with the cricket in this country, where you have one thing on the telly, but you turn the sound right down and just have Test Match Special on?
Yeah.
Would that work to have TMS on?
That'd be great. Just
talking over Angela Merkel.
I think that'd be absolutely wonderful.
It probably would work, weirdly.
It would.
My grandpa used to do that. My grandpa's Welsh. Listeners at home may not know. And he used to watch very low league Welsh language rugby on the TV, mute the sound, and then listen to the English commentary over the wireless. Same technique.
Okay.
Didn't know that happened on the other side of the border, though.
That's good stuff. What a weird one. I'm quite interested in that.
I
think that's a good story. I like that a lot.
Yeah. So moving on. In America, the French obviously are quite strident when it comes to promoting their culture, quite rightly, quite fairly, abroad. their embassies do a lot of work to promote culture, make sure people get involved, get exposed to the French language. And one of the best initiatives that they do is in New York. It's called Films on the Green. And basically what they do is get together a coterie of cultural heavyweights to curate a Francophone film season, and each film is shown in a different New York public park.
That's good, isn't it?
It's great really idea. Cool. So we've already had Jean-Luc Godard's Contempt. Jim Jarmusch has put forward his selection. We've also had a selection from Laurie Anderson, who's kind of a famous New York sonic artist.
Cool people they've got.
Yeah, really cool people. Yeah, and the final screening of this season is going to be on the lawns of Columbia University on the 7th of September. It's going to be François Truffaut's The Wild Child. I've never seen it.
Nice.
Have you?
No, you've seen it.
No, not seen it. No.
No of it.
Are you a Francophone cinemaphile, Tom? I'm
yes.
looking at you.
Oui.
No, you're not.
Oui.
No. Nor.
No, I love a bit of French cinema when I've got the patience.
Can I trail to an upcoming Monocle broadcast?
Oh, please do, Rob.
Isabelle Huppert appearing on The Big Interview.
Oh, yes, you
that?
Can. You
so
can.
I was in Dublin last week talking French cinema to interview one of the titans of French cinema, Isabelle Huppert, the fantastic actress. She's made over 100 films. She worked with Truffaut. She worked with Godard. She
luminous
worked with,
screen presence.
She's amazing, amazing. I was a little bit nervous. It was really funny, kicking about in this big old room.
And that season, on a complete tangent, The Big Interview, stellar names.
Who
Isabelle
else have we got,
Tom? Well, people will have heard Massimo Bottura already.
Yep.
Legendary, the world's greatest chef.
He's one of my favourite cyclists. Oh, chefs, yep. the king of the mountains.
Great. And that was very much just the apéritif.
You can drop the French thing now.
All right, fine.
Okay.
Yes,
okay. And finally.
Continue à tout Henri.
In light of FARC, the Colombian rebel group having metastasized from an armed paramilitary group into a political party. The Pope's coming. The Pope's coming to smooth over the transition.
Phew.
I know. That's what I said.
And I'm pretty sure no one's ever rocked up in Latin America in the name of Roman Catholicism and caused any trouble, have they?
It always goes well.
It's always going to be fine.
It's always ended well, hasn't it?
Definitely. He's going
on. My favourite Neil Young songs I'm reminded of here.
He's going on an apostolic journey to Colombia. I think that's how you say it. But it's interesting, I think. The Vatican. And I think that it has its diplomatic wing. There's some weird division of powers within the Vatican itself. Is it the Holy See takes care of the diplomatic side of things? Very active in parts of the world where that religion prevails.
Yeah. Well, and they're still often mooted as being like the only potential
kingmaker.
And you look elsewhere, even in across Venezuela, there's very bitter disagreements, very entrenched positions, and people still say no, get on the blower to the old pontiff.
No, I find it fascinating. Of course, he was also instrumental. At least the Vatican was instrumental in negotiating the initial ceasefire. Last year.
They've been good. I think they've been good for the FARC, I think.
Let's watch that space.
Thank you very much indeed, Henry. This is the Monocle Summer Weekly. We'll be speaking to Andrew Ellis next.
Buckle up, put the armrest down and slide away that table. The third edition of The Escapist, Monocle's annual travel-focused journal, has landed. Our editors and bureau chiefs offer you their take on those far-flung places where opportunity and great design find a home. We head to Semmering in Austria, a sleeping architectural beauty being gently awoken by an ambitious set of hospitality entrepreneurs. Then we take a drive down Turkey's liberal west coast and dust up on Broome's long history of welcoming new arrivals to Western Australia. Also, our culture editor, Rob Bound, sifts the treasure from the trash in Benidorm. We also reveal the winner of Monocle's third annual restaurant awards, as well as a crop of comfy new hotels in which to rest your head. The Escapist is your summer set piece, packed with the sunniest and smartest insights from leaders in the travel industry. The Escapist, on newsstands now.
Download Meet the Writers to join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to the modern-day adventurer, travel writer, entertainer, and motorcycle fanatic, Charlie Borman. He speaks about his Hollywood-influenced childhood with his father, the director John Borman, his bike tours around the world with Ewan McGregor, and how he recovered from a traumatic and near-fatal accident. That's Charlie Borman on Meet the Writers, available as a podcast now.
We We've all heard of the odd long-forgotten Picasso or a rediscovered Van Gogh hiding in a murky basement or a dusty attic. But what about lost works that are lying in plain sight? Those with no signature or featuring an unknown sitter, the ones we simply don't know much about.
Art Detective is a site established by the charity Art UK, which throws the identification of obscure works open to the public. Online now, they're celebrating helping identify over 100 works since launching in 2014. To talk us through a few of them, we're joined by the director of Art UK, Andrew Ellis. Andrew, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Good to have you with us. Let's start, though, before we drill down into the detective work, with the big picture, see what I've done there, of Art UK. Tell us a bit about the kind of resource, I guess, that's at the nation's disposal and how there's already all of these interesting sort of tentacles that join it all together.
Art UK is the online home for the nation's art collection. It's a big collaboration with collections across the country, some 3,000 collections across the country. It's a platform that they share to showcase their art to the world. And it exists because many of them can't show their art online themselves. Many of them are small collections. They just don't have the resources. And one of the principal reasons for starting this project is that not only was a lot of the art not photographed, but much of it was not on show. Probably some 80% of the oil paintings, which are the predominant medium on the site at the moment, are not on show. Collections just don't have the space to show all the art they own. And some of the art is in, you know, public buildings where we don't have routine public access. And so what is publicly owned was not really publicly accessible. And so this project is radically transforming the access by giving everyone across the world free access to the UK's public art collections online.
There is a bit of a state of the art nation. This is everything that we kind of collectively own. So this is essentially some huge online exhibition of everything that the British taxpayer, the British subject owns.
That's right. And it's interesting. It's not just museums. Only a third of the institutions on the site are museums. The other two-thirds include university collections, hospital collections, mayor's parlours, local authority collections, National Trust, government art collections. So it's incredibly diverse, you know, from the Shetland Isles down to the Scilly Isles.
And the Art Detective thing, this is a nice specificity. In fact, this is the kind of hook that we've drawn you in on today, Andrew, is this Art Detective thing. This is, a newish string to the bow of Art UK. There is obviously a lot of mystery around who painted what. Sometimes, which seems like a crazy thing, but as we said in the introduction, when there's no attribution on a painting, when there's no signature, you're trying to do a bit of detective work to match paintings with painters and try and find some of the interesting provenance behind some of these works. How did this kick off, this side of Art UK?
So the reason for this is that there's still a lot of mysteries to be solved across the nation's art collection. We estimate some 30,000 of the 200,000 works don't have artist attributions. There are many thousands of portraits where we don't know the sitter. We often don't know the event that's portrayed or the landscape. And many of the collections, interestingly, as I was saying earlier, are not museums. They don't have curators. Many of the museums, in actual fact, might specialise in furniture or armories and don't have an art curator. And so what we've tried to do is to help all those collections by connecting them with expertise across the world amongst the general public. That is basically a digital exercise. It's effectively a crowdsourcing exercise in which
people basically write into you and go, hang on, I know that was my great great aunt.
Exactly
who
like
sat
that.
This for this portrait, and they lived in Derby, and this is blah blah blah. This is how you
exactly like that.
Together.
So we had a case a couple of years ago where a broadcaster, Tom Sutcliffe, asked the question about a group portrait in the government art collection. It was by an artist called Geoffrey Tibble, and in it, someone was looking at it looked like a print of a West African sculpture. And Tom asked the question, what is he looking at? What are they discussing? And then this incredible discussion took place in which, halfway through the discussion, one of the daughters of the artist joined it and said, in actual fact, the person who's in the chair looking at that print is my father, and here's a photograph. And then another of the daughters came in and said, in actual fact, this is actually the object that he's looking at because we now have it in the house, which he left to us. So that sort of thing is happening all the time.
It's very satisfying when you get that sort of concrete verification. And the anecdote as well.
And the anecdote. Yeah. And obviously the range of contributions crosses from old master specialists through to family historians, through to people who are connected in the way I've just explained, people who live in on the Yorkshire Moors and know a particular location, or someone who lives in Holland who can spot a particular location in Holland that's not mentioned in the title. And so the way it works is that the collections might ask a question. You know, we have a particular portrait. We've been dying to know who this portrait is of, and the debate starts that way. Or it's actually someone writing in saying, I think I can tell you, or I'll make a suggestion, and then the discussion takes place around it.
And it's funny, Rob sort of playfully mentioned in the introduction this idea, and I guess it's a fantasy many have of the hidden Picasso, or, you know, the old master in the attic. But in some ways, I guess, there's something more compelling almost about these almost social historical aspects to this, piecing together those things, placing things in context. I mean, that's as compelling a story. If you did find a Picasso, you'd be pretty happy for a number of reasons.
You'd be fine with that, Tom.
But there's something more compelling about that almost, isn't
Indeed.
There?
I would say, I mean, outside the Art Detective initiative, we've had discoveries of a Van Dyck and a Gainsborough and a Jordaens as a result of the work. But the discoveries, as you say, are at lower level than that. But just as fascinating. Mm. And what's also so interesting is, I think, the way the discussions take place. They are international. They're between members of the public. It's all incredibly genial. Or you'd have the Art History Institute of the Netherlands and a museum in Warsaw joining into a discussion to help with an attribution. So it's wonderful to watch in action.
And you gave us a figure at the beginning, Andrew, of how many works are in this collection. And I have no brain, so I've forgotten what that was.
So overall, on the site, there are 215,000 artworks. So mainly oil paintings.
And how many weren't attributed that are now? How quick to...
It's a very small number. Okay. So the number of reattributions is, you know, including the reattributions outside the Art Detective Project, in the tens.
And do people kind of club together? I mean, this seems like a project for people that have not just a side interest in art, but maybe it is their main interest, but can do this sort of a bit of this sort of stuff as a consultation on the side. You know, you can go home and kind of attribute 10 paintings of an evening. Is this the sort of people you want, or do you want it to be this kind of slow burn, as you said, genial, anecdotal way of naming and placing these works?
I think we'd like a combination of the two, really.
Yeah.
I mean, a number of the people, for example, are retired curators.
You know? Yeah.
And interestingly, because actually it's not really competitive at all, in actual fact. You know, people build on each other's suggestions, and in each case, they're groups that the paintings are put into. So if there's a sort of an 18th century military figure, that would go into the 18th century portraiture as well as into the military group. And those people who are interested in both those groups will join that discussion, and an authority will help lead the discussion through to a conclusion, someone who works completely pro bono on this. I mean, the enthusiasm and contribution that people make to this for no pay is incredible.
And you've already alluded to the fact that there's some global contributions. I just wonder, obviously, your charity is Art UK, but do we need, you know, Art World or some kind of global variant to draw in? Because presumably there's contributions that are being made and can be made from a still wide, you know, you could cast the net almost around the whole planet almost.
Indeed, we had a year or so ago a contribution from South Africa about a particular train that was notable in that country. Interestingly, just over 50% of our web traffic comes from overseas, so there's a sort of natural interest.
It's already global.
Yeah,
I'm behind the times sometimes. That's the way it works.
And I don't want to get all Antiques Roadshow with you here, Andrew, but is there an idea of the valuation of things as well? That people, I mean, they're obviously in the public ownership, these works, so maybe even more so, it's kind of good to know what they're worth. I mean, there is, I suppose, for most of these works, if they're not a name artist, but they just do have an interesting story and interesting provenance behind them, that is obviously of social value. Has anything turned out to be something, a major work?
Through the Art Detective Network, no, but otherwise, outside that, as I said, there was a painting which had been down as a 19th century copy of a Van Dyck, which was proven to be a real Van Dyck in the Bows in County Durham.
Yeah.
In a St. Albans Museum, an unknown 18th century portrait was shown to be by Gainsborough. So there, obviously, there would be, I suppose,
good
value
thing, good
associated
to have amongst your with that.
But, but in all honesty, this project has nothing to do with financial value. It's all about cultural value and cultural interest.
Before we end, I wanted to bring you up on a phrase you used in your first answer, Mayor's Parlour. What do you think about that? What do you think about a mayor? When you think of a mayor's parlour, Tom, what do you think of? How do you think you might be entertained in a mayor's parlour?
Well, the mind boggles, surely.
It does boggle, doesn't it?
It's sort of, to me,
kind of got a place where you hang the chain that is almost like a sort of mannequin, like a Stockman dummy. Do you know what I mean? It would be something like that.
The number of mayors on the site is...
I was going to say, there must be a hell of a lot of mayors and
incredible.
School governors.
And interestingly, there are a large number of mayors who are unidentified as well.
Really?
So, yes.
Well, maybe that's the sequel to this chat. We'll have Andrew in a year's time when he's uncovered just who those mayors are and what they've been doing in their parlour. For the time being, Andrew Ellis, head of Art UK and of Art Detective. Thank you very much for joining us.
Great pleasure. Thank you both.
And for those looking to learn more or share your own expertise, head to artuk.org/Art Detective. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Rob, I think it's time for some music.
I'm exceptionally pleased to hear what you've got lined up for us today, Tom.
I know you're going to love this, as are all of our lucky listeners. This is the recently formed duo of Melbourne's Courtney Barnett and Philadelphia's Kurt Vile with Over Everything.
When I'm all alone on my own by my lonesome and there ain't a single nother soul around, I wanna dig into my guitar.
That was Kurt Vile and Courtney Barnett there with Over Everything. I know Tom Hall, our producer, is a fan of Kurt Vile. I'm a fan of Kurt Vile myself. That is an excellent song.
Good
it's
pick.
Worth checking out the video. Bit of gender bending. Right? What's wrong with
that? I thought that was what was coming up next on the weekly.
You and I, Tom, we're going to take it to the limit. It's Sunday afternoon radio. Indeed it is. You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly.
All through August, we've been enjoying summertime stories from Monocle's correspondents around the globe. We're celebrating the season, of course, but also giving listeners a gentle nudge in the direction of our easy-to-make, Rob, four-part August newspaper, the Monocle Summer Weekly, the last issue of which is on all good newsstands now.
Thank goodness. To keep things on the sunny side, we're off to Greece this week, where Monocle's Athens correspondent Natalie Savarikas has been enjoying the city's open-air film festival.
It's not unusual to see crowds milling around on the pedestrian cobble street of Dionysio Aropagitu, which circles the ancient Acropolis Rock in the heart of the Greek capital. But this evening, an unusually large number of people have started congregating opposite the Acropolis Museum. They're patiently waiting for the sun to fully disappear, because as soon as it does, another movie of the Athens Open Air Film Festival will start. For the moment, the large screen, which is held up by inflatable pillars, is showing adverts. So we take the opportunity to speak to Maria, a web designer who's been attending these events religiously.
Times are hard, so it's good that it's free. But I think beyond that, the opportunity to watch such classic and, you know, good films outdoors, you know, it's why would it not draw anyone? But it does get very busy, so it is always a good idea to try and get there early. But why would you not come? I can't think of a reason. It's just cinema, great outdoor places, it's free, it's just the best.
Do you know this movie? What brings you here today to this specific one?
I know the movie, I've seen the movie, but it was a long time ago, so to be honest, I don't really remember that much of it. I know John Hurt's in it, and I think he's fantastic, so I'm really looking forward to reacquainting myself with a film that I've forgotten, but I know it was good.
The 1986 independent film Kiss of the Spider Woman, directed by Hector Babenco, is the choice of the evening. William Hurt won accolades for his performance as a gay political prisoner, including an Oscar. Greeks and foreigners alike of all backgrounds are scrambling to find a seat in the shadow of a 2,500-year-old temple. Like Dimitri, a pharmacist who hasn't missed the screening since finding out about the festival a few weeks ago.
What do you think of this open-air film festival? What is that you prefer about it?
The atmosphere. They select places that are not only... Now we are at the bottom of Acropolis. The other time was in, just out the Archaeological Museum of Athens. And so these are very... special spots of in Athens, either touristic, but also not only for tourist reasons, as for historic places for us. And so the atmosphere is splendid, and that's why I try to follow it.
As darkness now begins to settle and the lights illuminating the Parthenon temple are on, all the rows of seats are taken. Many are standing, but Marios and Chrysoula are straddling a small wall they found as they wait for the movie to begin.
Do you think this is something you might come back to again, or you would recommend a friend, and why?
I will recommend because of the atmosphere, of course, and also because the festival is in great places in Athens and like hidden places. And if you like, go to the movies. It's a perfect place, it's free. I would totally recommend.
For the seventh year in a row, the festival has screened relatively new releases, but mainly classics, for free, under the stars, in the warm Athenian breeze. The organizers take the cinematic experience to another level by showing over 20 films in very, very iconic venues throughout the capital, like museums, town squares, or even by the beach. Film critic Lukas Katsikas has been an organizing part of this yearly event since its very beginning, and he was appointed its artistic director right as he took on the reins of the Athens International Film Festival last year.
We kind of wanted to establish a certain magical chemistry between the city and the cinema, and watch what the tension might be if you try to screen a film on an unorthodox and quite unexpected location of the city.
How have the crowds reacted to the arrival of the Athens Open Air Film Festival, and have you seen a change or a difference in their response throughout the years, especially with the onset of the crisis?
Well, first of all, it's very important to note that the Athens Open Air Film Festival is a free festival. From the very first year of the Athens Open Air Film Festival, the crowds were big. But during the crisis and the cataclysmic changes that it brought to our lives, the audiences grew bigger and bigger. And during the last years, the festival became something of an opportunity for to escape your troubles, to find a temporary relief through the experience of watching a film.
How helpful have the Greek authorities been in this endeavor?
The Athens Open Air Film Festival is a large enterprise, and it couldn't be done without the help of the authorities. What we were trying to do was something, some sort of a cultural tourism. So it goes without saying that the authorities would be more than glad to share their city with the people who inhabit it and for the people who visit it.
Tell us a bit more about how you choose the movies that you decide to screen.
We choose the films we like to see for the very first time, we never got the chance to see, or the films we want to see again on a big screen, because not many classical films are being shown nowadays on big screens, and it's quite a sight to behold. For instance, we wanted to see for the very first time after many, many years, The Kiss of the Spider Woman, the actor Babenko film, which you watched underneath the Acropolis. And it was the very first time that this particular film got to be shown on a big screen, and the Greek audience had the opportunity to see it again or to watch it for the very first time. And I think that the people loved it. So it was a great joy for us that we got the approval of our audience for the film. And that is something that kind of happened for all the films that we screened this year, because we kind of took a walk down memory lane in cinema, watching films from all the decades and films that concerned many different spectators. We had cult movies, we had classical movies, we had obscure horror movies, we had Oscar films, we have films from all around the world, from Australia, from Spain, from China, from France, from the US, etc., etc. And it was a kaleidoscope of cinema from an era back when films used to draw audiences from different places and different mentalities into the whole experience, something that no longer happens, I think.
With the onset of the fall, the open-air season will come to an end. But moviegoers here aren't too broken-hearted about it. Another cinema celebration will take place, as the 23rd Athens International Film Festival will be raising its curtains in just a few weeks. For Monocle in Athens, this is Natalie Savarikas.
Thanks, Natalie. And for more summertime stories, pick up a copy of the last, for now, Rob, edition of the Monocle Summer Weekly on all good newsstands.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
It is almost time, Rob, to hit the old dusty trail on the Monocle Summer Weekly. But we are going to hit said trail in real style this week.
That is correct, Tom. We're going to be ending with a chat about an unmistakable piece of US travel culture, the Airstream trailer.
Beloved by both movie stars and more vintage-savvy roadgoers alike, the curvy aluminium, or as they would say, aluminum design of an Airstream dates back to the 1930s. Now designer Karen Flett, who herself has worked on movies such as The Hobbit trilogy, has compiled a book about the distinctive mobile homes called Living the Airstream Life.
It looks back at the history of a design classic and also tells the stories of those choosing to call an Airstream home today. A little earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Karen, who's in Seattle.
Karen, thanks very much for joining us. We're talking about your new book, Living the Airstream Life. The first question I was curious about, this is obviously a topic very close to your heart and something you're very passionate about, but do you currently live the Airstream life yourself? Do you live in one?
I own a 1971 18-foot caravelle, a very cute little trailer. I haven't been living on it for a little while, but I'm starting to live full-time in a month, actually, to promote my book. I have, in the past, lived in a 10-foot trailer as well, so I'm very used to small spaces and love this lifestyle.
And you mentioned there some terminology, a caravelle. I mean, in the UK, Some of these kinds of trailers have a bit of an unflattering image because, A, they don't look as cool remotely, but, you know, we call it a caravan. Has Airstream trailers known the same way across the world? What is a caravelle? Tell me what that means.
So caravelle is actually the name of the length of the trailer from that year. So they each length in the 1970s and different eras as well are named by their length. And so a caravelle specifically refers to the 18-foot length in the 1970s. So there was also a safari, a trade wind, which was 25-foot, overlander, which is 27-foot. And so they're all named specifically relates to their length. In the United States, they are referred to as trailers, which basically means a caravan, as it does in the UK. But in America, a caravan is actually a group of trailers or a group of caravans traveling together. So it does get a little bit confusing in the terminology.
And there's a duality to the sort of visual aesthetic of these vehicles, isn't there? Because, I mean, one side of it is the kind of the wildness of the open road and just hitting the road and being self-sufficient and doing things your own way. And then the other kind of unavoidable sort of mind, the image that we get in our mind is of Hollywood, because these are sort of synonymous with, or what we're told maybe from the golden era more than today, this is where Hollywood stars would spend their time while they're on the film lot, when they're not in front of the camera. Which side of that appeals most to you?
Definitely the travelling side. I think obviously they're made into gorgeous spaces in which the film stars can spend their time between shoots. But the side that Wally Byam, who was the founder of Airstream and why he invented them in the first place, was to be able to travel and be able to experience as many environments, communities, people that you possibly can. And I think a lot of people fall in love with Airstream initially because they're so beautiful and they're so amazingly designed. When their heart falls in love with them, when their soul falls in love with them, is when they understand the wandering spirit that has really been a part of, you know, their creation from the get-go. And the community around them is really incredible as well. Even in the UK, there is actually a very solid community around Airstreams who love them. There is an Airstream club there, and then there are some fantastic renovators who take vintage Airstreams and make them pretty beautiful as well. So there's a designer called American Retro Caravans, and they are in the south, and they import Airstreams into the UK and then make, redesign their interiors and sell them on. So they're absolutely beautiful. Definitely check them out.
And we're talking to you in Seattle today, but anyone can hear that that's probably not the place where you originally came from. You've got a New Zealand twang going on, I believe. Whereabouts have you been in Airstreams? Is it just a USA thing, or have you been across different continents and places? Where have you travelled with an Airstream?
Personally, just in America, but I have met many travellers throughout the UK and Australia, New Zealand, and there is also many in Europe through France, Italy, that travel in those areas. So personally, just in America, but they are very usable, even with America's obviously known for its very wide roads and a lot of space to travel in. But even through a lot of Europe, a lot of people still use the Airstream, which is fantastic.
Let's talk about New Zealand for a minute, because that's also synonymous with a series of films, very well known, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. And you've had a hand in those latter works, The Hobbit films. Tell us about what your role was there and how that has led into other sort of professions in your life.
I was the art department coordinator on The Hobbit films, so I was part of the art department creating sets and props and set dressing for the three films, which was an incredible experience and very valuable. From that, I actually moved into helping out with the behind-the-scenes books, and so that led me to become the publishing manager for Weta Publishing, which I did for several years, and which also led me to write this book of my own and my own passion in travel. So it's been a wonderful journey and a very fantastic opportunity.
I'm just interested. This is probably a weird comparison to make. Hobbits are quite small. Yes. I imagine, I know there was some perspective magic going on in those films. Did you learn anything designing on those films about sort of designing for a small contained space like an Airstream?
It's funny you say that, because Bag End, which is where Bilbo Baggins lives, was an incredible place. And I think for me, that was the excitement of being able to work on those films and to walk through that space and the curved walls and the space layout. And it was just so beautiful, wonderfully designed space that also kind of quite emulates the Airstream in the curved walls. And I think it gives a real sense of comfort, as Bag End does, that is sort of a space without walls hitting a ceiling and having that corner angle. And I think Airstream actually does it really well, that you don't feel like you're in a small space. You feel like the walls go on forever and the ceiling goes on forever. And so it actually feels really comforting and not a small confined, claustrophobic space. So Big End was definitely my highlight working on the film.
Finally, I mean, these are not relics of the past. People use them every day in practical senses. And one of the nice things about the book is that you go out and you meet these people who live in and are using these trailers. Tell us maybe just about a couple of those people. Who are some of the interesting characters that occupy this world?
Well, there are so many, and I think that was the hard thing in choosing the few, as I only have so many pages within the book to tell the stories of everybody. The reason I chose the certain people that I did was just sort of to cover the different types of stories or the different angles in which people would be concerned about or want to understand more about within this lifestyle. So one of the families, Katie and Rob, are the parents, and they have 7 children between them from previous marriages, and they also foster children as well. So they often ended up travelling with between sort of 9 to 12 people. And so you're thinking, how do you fit 12 people in an Airstream? And so they did an incredible design where they created bunk beds and sliding couches that came out to beds that actually created an Airstream 32 foot long that slept 12 people very comfortably. It even had a dishwasher and all the luxuries of home. So that was an incredible family to meet, and what they'd done with the design was absolutely stunning.
As you mentioned, you're going to be heading out on the road in your own Airstream shortly, but do you have a house to as a backup? What's going on with your living arrangement?
Yes, I have a home in New Zealand, but basically I do spend all of my other time travelling or in an Airstream trailer. I think it gives you the freedom to respond to opportunities, which I think is probably the key thing for me in having this way of travel, is reducing the overhead costs and things that, you know, in your everyday life your money disappears to, that you're actually able to spend that money in following your dreams and opportunities that come up for you, whether it's a new job or visiting a new place or spending, you know, an extra few weeks in a place that you fell in love with. There is just so many opportunities that you can take hold of and grab with two hands when you live in an Airstream.
Author and designer Karen Flett there, and Living the Airstream Life is available right now from HarperCollins.
That was a really good show. I really enjoyed it today, Tom.
We had
nice guests.
We had aluminium Airstreams. We had art detection.
We had Natalie Savarakis.
And we had Henry Rhys Sheridan very much setting the agenda for the week ahead. Other people who are deserving of thanks this week, Rob?
I'd have said Tom Hall. Our show today was produced by him, and Kieran Banerjee. He was our studio manager today. That's been it for today's Monocle Weekly. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bowne.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.